Hello, my name is Jen Hickey. Welcome to the WEN podcast, a series of conversations with people as they share their WEN moments. Recognizing these times can change our destiny, help us to stop hiding behind the past or clinging to a future that may or may not happen. This podcast is about recognizing the power of the WEN moments. Hi, welcome back to the WEN podcast. So in this week's podcast, I am chatting to menopause specialist Dr. Caoimhe Hartley. She has returned to Ireland having spent a number of years working in Canada in a specialist women's health facility, and she is currently setting up her own clinic in Dalkey in Ireland. So today we are having a conversation about all things to do with perimenopause and menopause. And she's also answering many listener questions that I have received over the past couple of months in setting up this podcast. So please share this conversation. It's really important that we keep talking about this topic and getting it out there to as many people as possible. And again, if you have any questions from today's podcast, maybe you could get in touch with me via the website or on Instagram. So I start off by asking Caoimhe just to give us a little bit of a background to what she's been doing in the last couple of years. Thanks a mil, guys.
Yeah, so my background is in GP primarily. So I qualified as a GP in 2013 and I did all my training in Ireland and then took a notion with my other half and we headed off to Canada, just the two of us. And we lived in a place called Alberta. So we were there for just over five years. So I worked in a big women's clinic, a real like a dedicated women's clinic that had started off fairly small and then grew and grew while I was there. And it was really specialized. It was brilliant. I got so much exposure to women's health. It was great. And while I was there, then I did some extra training in menopause. I don't know how I ended up sort of doing menopause. I don't really remember the origins of it, except that I loved it and liked that I was, you know, able to help these women. And it sort of just snowballed, like it became a thing and, you know, it was brilliant. So so I went on to do some exams with the North American Menopause Society, and I became accredited with them after a few years. And then I did some teaching through, and I was an associate professor with the University of Alberta while I was there. And then we made the decision to move home, thankfully, just before the pandemic. So we came home dragging the three little ones and the dog behind us in 2019. And and now I'm here. So I'm opening up a menopause clinic, which will be based in South Dublin in Dalkey, and hoping to start seeing patients in March. Yeah,
that's That's great. Brilliant. Wow. Gosh, that sounds amazing, actually, the whole experience.
It was actually, yeah, it was really inspiring. I worked with these amazing women. And I think the attitude over there is, I mean, general practice in Ireland is, you know, fantastic. And like, I mean, you know, the GPs here take on everything. They're just jack of all trades. They're brilliant. There was quite an attitude of subspecializing over there. So within general practice, you were kind of encouraged to find an area that maybe, you know, you really liked, that spoke to you, that, you know, that you wanted to specialize in a little bit or do some extra training in. So so it was great to have that support and be able to do the exams and get some extra learning.
And they're obviously way ahead of us then in terms of menopause and perimenopause and all of that.
I wouldn't say way ahead. I think, you know, it's just different. And some of their, like what they lean towards in their prescriptions and what's available, and it's just different. So it's really nice that when I came home, I became accredited with the British Menopause Society, and I'm a member of the European Menopause and Andropause Society. So it's nice to have the input of these two, you know, other like two sides of the Atlantic, I guess, and to see how things can be done differently on either side. So it's just a different approach.
Sure. Okay. Well, I suppose a good place to start, perhaps, I know after the first podcast that we did in the first series on menopause, it still kind of feels a little bit like there's this, I don't know what the right word is, shame perhaps, or I don't know, reluctance to even discuss it. But certainly the confusion around perimenopause seems to be the thing. I have loads of questions, and we're going to get to some kind of questions in a little while. But do you find that yourself, or is it by the time they get to you, it's all kind of figured out in their heads?
It depends. I do think perimenopause is a bit more challenging than menopause. I think we're getting better at understanding. Look, menopause is the loss of estrogen in, like, at its most simple kind of level. That's really what's happening. we lose this hormone that our ovaries produce first during our reproductive years, and then we get this knock-on effect to our well-being and our health and how we feel because of that. But perimenopause is so much more confusing because it's not as simple, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing that on the North American side of things, they are a bit more proactive or maybe a bit more tuned into the concept of perimenopause and the challenges that women can face as a consequence. So I think perimenopause, I actually have a real interest in it in particular. I think it's because it's a bit more challenging and a bit more confusing almost.
Yeah.
So what happens, we think, is that on average from somewhere around the age of 40-ish, but obviously it's highly individual, that you start to get changes in how you produce these hormones. So it's not as straightforward as just, I'm now estrogen deficient and, you know, I kind of deal with that. It's just really confusing because you can go through periods of time where you have too much estrogen when you're in perimenopause, and then periods of time where you've too little, and then you kind of like bounce back and forth between the two. And so it's this kind of crazy roller coaster effect, and I think that's what actually leads to an awful lot of the symptoms and problems that perimenopause creates, is because of that. But it's poorly understood, and how to treat it is, you know, is challenging as well. It's like you're on this moving field, like the goalposts keep shifting in perimenopause. So it's challenging.
And
it can
also
mimic menopause.
Yeah, yeah. And also some of the symptoms, certainly what I've learned anyway, is that, gosh, the range, it's just huge. So what you necessarily might not think is anything to do with menopause actually could be, or sorry, perimenopause. What do you think is kind of, what's the most confusing symptom out there for women, do you think? In perimenopause.
Oh God, like where to start? Because because it's so individual. And I think one of the challenges for people talking about perimenopause or menopause for that matter, like one of the issues is it's really hard because we're not all the same. And so you can have like a group of women and one person might say, well, I have the classic, you know, I've really bad hot flushes and I'm getting some night sweats and my skin has gone a bit dry and like this real kind of textbook menopause, you know. But the person sitting next to her might kind of be like, what are you talking about? Like I don't have any of that, but I've got dreadful mood swings and, you know, I've burning tongue. Like, what the hell is that about? And I've, you know, and so on. So it can just vary so much that sometimes it's hard to find common ground. And I think with perimenopause, because you get the kind of fluctuations in the hormone levels, that can also create, you can go through phases of time of having sort of no symptoms and then a period of time where you have symptoms. So they come and go, which can lead to women thinking like, I'm going crazy because I felt dreadful for a few months, but maybe it was all in my head because now I'm grand and my periods are regular again. And so they don't kind of look for help or reach out and they start to doubt themselves. So it's really disconcerting.
And I suppose the scary bit is that you could be like that for many, many years.
That's the thing. Yeah, it can go on for an indefinite amount of time, really, for some women. It's really hard to put a timeline on it, you know, for them.
Gosh. And would it be safe to say then that some of your symptoms in perimenopause, which could start at any stage, could mimic PMS?
Yeah. One of the best ways of probably describing perimenopause is just like that. So if you think with PMS, so normal cycle, you've your 4 weeks and you ovulate, you know, in the middle usually. And then 2 weeks after you ovulate, you get your period if you're not pregnant. But in that 2 weeks from when you ovulate to when you get your period, your hormones change. And it's that fall of estrogen and progesterone just before you get your period. That's what creates the environment. That's what brings on a period. It's that loss of those hormones. But the amount of fluctuation you get in a normal kind of reproductive cycle, you're going up and down a little bit, but it's not like violent waves up and down. But in perimenopause, that's what happens. So you're dropping from a much higher amount sometimes to a much lower amount. So it's like a bigger roller coaster. So instead of like a little bump on the road, you're this kind of big drop off a cliff effect. So your PMS symptoms come from that loss of hormones. So obviously, if you're getting that happening more frequently, or if the drop is more steep, you're going to get much more severe PMS and they often last longer. So most women with perimenopause might notice a change in the regularity of their periods. So they might notice that their cycle changes, but that can be anything. It can be that their cycle becomes longer. For a lot of women, it actually becomes shorter and their periods might become heavier, which can be really problematic in itself. As we all know, it's a pain to have heavy periods, but really disruptive for some women, just practically for them to even get out of the house and get out and about. So that might be something they notice. I hear an awful lot of like mood swings and irritability. Oh my God, the, you know, this feeling of rage at times and this horrible, disconcerting, like change in your personality. It's horrible. So that can happen. And then just like you said with PMS, so breast tenderness and bloating, even a change in your skin, acne can happen. And usually though, if you ask them, it's usually cyclical. Or at least for a period of time, for a few months, they'll notice, yeah, I was okay. I had a good couple of weeks, then a dreadful couple of weeks. And I was like, you know, nobody wanted to be around me. And then I was grand again for a couple of weeks. And they're up and down and up and down. Yeah. And so it's really, it's upsetting, you know.
And it is, you know, like you feel, like you said, like you're losing your mind. And then there is a shame and there's a bit of an embarrassment and there's a bit of like, oh my God. And possibly then, you know, the fear of, God, does this mean I'm getting old or, you know, this horrible sense of losing who you are and affecting relationships, marriages, you know, everything, it seems.
Yeah, and I'm sure it affects different people in different ways, but I'm not sure any part of your life is really left untouched. If you are in the majority of women who have kind of moderate to severe symptoms, because like you said, it can affect your ability to work, so how productive you are, your energy levels, how well you sleep. And then there's the knock-on effect of, like, I mean, without, you know, normal sleep, most of us are pretty cranky and irritable and not as productive and don't have as much energy. And then, like you said, then that has an effect on your relationships. It's really hard for other people to kind of ride the roller coaster with you and to know, you know, she's going through something and she'll be okay in a week or two. And like even your relationship with your children, if you have them, and so on, like every facet of your life is kind of impacted upon.
So let's talk a little bit then about obviously what's available HRT wise. So, because obviously it's changed an awful lot and I'm sure you've seen huge change in the last few years and the safety of it and what kind of thing women can expect.
So again, if you look at, I suppose, if you look at perimenopause and menopause as being kind of two different beasts, you know, with menopause it's a bit more straightforward, because if someone has estrogen deficiency and we're talking about HRT, it is sort of hormone replacement. We're not actually replacing hormones to the same level, so we're not giving women back every last bit of estrogen that they had previously. We don't need to achieve the same result, but that's what you're aiming to do essentially, is replace some of the estrogen. And the reason, I guess, is that because, number one, without estrogen, our well-being is usually affected. So you just don't feel as well, you know. But also our health is affected. So we know that you can get changes to your cardiovascular system. Your blood vessels can change. They lose their flexibility and elasticity. And you can see the, you know, the start of hypertension, which is high blood pressure. We see changes in cholesterol and so on. So your whole cardiovascular system can be affected. There's a whole other topic in itself to talk about the impact it has on immunity and autoimmune conditions and joints and all of that stuff. But bones are the other big thing that are really affected. So we see bone loss.
Yeah.
Or more specifically, loss of bone density.
Yeah.
It's definitely not kind of out there enough that we're talking about it, because it has a huge impact on the health system and on women's kind of overall health as they age. You get a loss of height in your spine. You can increase your risk of having any fracture, but in particular hip fractures. You can have chronic pain as well from osteoporosis if it becomes established. So that's something that we see from your final period onwards, this rapid loss of bone density. And estrogen can really help slow down.
And when you
loss.
Say that, you do, because I know I was researching this myself. I mean, you say rapid, it can change within a couple of months, really, can't it? Isn't that which?
Yeah, within, so the first 5 years from your last period onwards, we lose our bone density at about 2% per year. Like, it's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then after that, it kind of plateaus to maybe 1% per year loss of your bone density. And how much bone density you start with depends on lots of factors, like your genetics and your weight, your amount of exercise you've done, do you smoke, your medical history, and you know, countless other things. So, but from that point on, then it's a kind of this slowly, you just slowly decline with your density. So that's often why we'll order something like a DEXA scan or a bone density scan to get a baseline, to know what we're kind of
I've literally just recorded one, a podcast on osteoporosis, so it'll come in.
Oh, brilliant. So you're really up on it. Yeah, yeah.
So obviously HRT is not going to solve the world's problems. So it's an all round, everything has to be looked at, lifestyle, all of that. But let's talk about the actual HRT itself, because the different types, what happens. And I know, and then, you know, there's a bit of kind of the whole progesterone, that's another topic as well, because I know some of the questions that I had were about, you know, just it seems to be the not so nice part of HRT. But so there you go, a whole load of questions. 1, 2, 3, go.
Okay. HRT 101, let's go.
So
you have to look at why you're using it. So in perimenopause, because you're not deficient in it, we're not trying to really replace your estrogen. We're trying to bring a bit of stability and calmness back to this kind of mad, you know, fluctuating levels that you're having. We're trying to bring it back between the ditches a little, so you're not getting these big, massive drops in your hormone levels. So you're kind of using it for different purposes in perimenopause and menopause. But essentially, like if we're talking about HRT, the thing you're using and that we're prescribing is the same. So you're looking at, I suppose, estrogen specifically, and you can take estrogen in loads of different ways. You can take it as a tablet. It can be a patch or a gel through your skin. There's an estrogen spray. There's, you know, vaginal estrogen. There's estrogen that you can get as an implant. There's loads of different types, but the common ones would be either a tablet, a patch, or a gel. The patch and gel are essentially the same in terms of what their risk and usefulness is. The difference between them is really practicality, just what suits you. Some people like the gel is an everyday thing. The patch is something you would change twice a week. So it depends on your lifestyle. Some people find, I just prefer doing something every day, then I don't forget. Other people, it just doesn't suit them. So it's totally individual. But their risk is the same. And the oral estrogen through your mouth, like the, you know, tablet form of estrogen, that is different. And the reason is that when you take estrogen through your skin, it doesn't have to be metabolized or broken down by your liver. Whereas if you take estrogen as a tablet, it does pass through your liver. And it, which sounds like not a really big deal, but there's a lot of knock-on issues with that. So tablet form of estrogen broken down by your liver. And the problem is that then has an impact on other things that your liver is busy doing. So it actually increases some other protein, really important things like other proteins that your liver makes. One of which it makes clotting proteins and clotting factors, they're called. So if you take the tablet form of estrogen, we get an increased number of these clotting factors, which is why you get an increased amount of blood clots and stroke with the tablet form of estrogen, which might be fine if you're 40 something with a normal body mass index and you don't smoke and you're not high risk to begin with. But for most women, I'll end up saying, look, why go with any risk if we can avoid it?
And actually, that is one of the
dermal estrogen.
Yeah, that is one of the questions.
Yeah, I mean, it's convenient. Yeah. Like, to be fair, it's obviously more convenient to take a tablet and it's more acceptable. Most people are used to the thought of taking tablets, you know. So there's that aspect of it. It's definitely more convenient. But estrogen through your skin, tiny bit more time consuming, much safer. So won't have as much of an impact on things like thyroid, because again, your liver produces a hormone that binds to thyroid hormone. Same idea with testosterone levels can be affected by taking oral estrogen. And your clotting risk. So all of that is avoided with estrogen through your skin.
Okay.
So that's the estrogen bit.
And if you're taking a tablet with estrogen, is the progesterone combined in that tablet?
Some are. You don't have to take it. So you can take estrogen on its own as a tablet. Mm-hmm. There are several combination estrogen and progesterone tablets that are all in one. And again, convenience obviously is the reason that they're still around, you know. So the reason you take that second hormone, the nasty progesterone that no one seems to like. So the reason that that is there, its primary purpose is to protect the lining of your womb. So if I was to give you, you know, a ton of estrogen and give you nothing else, your lining inside your womb would react by getting thicker and thicker, which would lead to bleeding. But also over time, that could lead to the development of some abnormal cells in your womb. So like we're talking about womb cancer long term.
Yeah.
So we give you progesterone to balance that out. And then that's a whole other, like, you know, like challenge in itself, because progesterones are really individual. So what you like or the side effects you get from one progesterone are going to be different to the next. So they're highly individual. Yeah. So they're the challenge, all right, I'd say.
Okay. The kind of one that's been thrown about a bit, I know from the questions, the utrogestin, which is the body identical. Am I right in saying that?
That's right. Yeah. And actually on that topic, there's all this controversy over body identical and bioidentical and synthetic. Nope. And what does all of that mean?
That was another question. Bioidentical hormones. Are they,
your mind,
what are your thoughts basically on bioidentical?
So what we mean when we say body identical, all we mean is that if you were to look at it under a microscope, the chemical structure of body identical estrogen or body identical progesterone is the same as if I went and took estradiol or progesterone from your ovaries that they're producing and I stick them under a microscope as well. So it's literally identical to body estrogen or progesterone. So it probably is safer. Like that's borne out in most of the studies. All of like a lot of the estrogen we use in tablets and most of the estrogen that we use, almost all the estrogen that we use through our skin is body identical. So for the most part, you can kind of assume that unless you're on the old fashioned equine derived estrogen, which used to come from pregnant mares' urine, this is like, you don't want to know where you don't want to know where most of your food comes from. You probably don't want to know where most of your medication comes from either. But anyway, that old fashioned equine estrogen was synthetic. So they think that's higher risk. Anyway, estrogen is, for the most part, is body identical. So if you're seeing, you know, you can kind of assume that you're probably on body identical estrogen for the most part. But the progesterone, there is only one type of body identical progesterone. That's it. We have one. And that's your uterogestin or uterogestrin or utterogestrin or whatever, like people trip over it. It's a difficult one. But yeah, that it's micronized progesterone. So when they say micronized, what they mean is progesterone is quite a big molecule. And so they've had this challenge for years to know how to get people to absorb it. So it was a kind of like, I presume, like a sort of pharmaceutical or biochemical challenge to figure out how to make it into a medication that people could take that would then absorb through their stomach and be usable, because it's a big molecule. So micronizing it means, imagine putting it into like a pestle and mortar and basically pulverizing it. That's what it means when we say micronized progesterone. And then they bind it inside, I think it's sunflower oil is the capsule or some version of that. It's in Canada, it was sunflower oil anyway. And it helps get, you know, make that molecule more soluble. But anyway, that's the only body identical progesterone. And it is definitely considered the safest when you're looking at things like blood clot risk and breast cancer. But there's all these other synthetic progesterones out there, and they're not all bad.
Yeah. So the symptoms then that some women find when they start the eutrogestin, you know, it seems to affect mood a little bit, perhaps, or maybe feeling a bit nauseous. Are these kind of symptoms that will go over time, or how long should we give it? First of all, to kind of, because I know you're only taking it sometimes for 2 weeks of the month and some women are taking it every night. So I know that's a different, because I think
So for some women, they'll take what's called cyclical HRT, where if you've had, basically, if you're still having periods or you've had a period within the last year, you'll take cyclical. So you'll take your estrogen all of the time and then you'll take your progesterone for 2 weeks out of the month. Ish. Now it's nuanced, but that's as a rough guide. And the reason we do that is really to kind of mimic a normal cycle in someone who we think is still having, their ovaries are still having this kind of like month on month cycle. So we try and mimic that. The continuous progesterone, so you take usually a lower dose and it's every night throughout the month. So you're not taking a break. The reason we don't put everybody on continuous progesterone is because if you are still having a cycle in the background and I put you on continuous progesterone, you're likely to get a lot of breakthrough bleeding. So just random spotting and breakthrough bleeding, and you'll stop it. You won't want to take it. But the continuous progesterone is safer. So the rates of womb cancer are quite a bit lower with continuous progesterone than they are with cyclical. Yeah. So ultimately, we try and sort of move everybody over ultimately to continuous progesterone. And there's various ways of, you know, like there's different things we look at in order to kind of time that and know when to move people over. But
so if somebody, say, is really struggling with their eutrogestin for the 2 weeks of the month, and perhaps the dose is, because you were saying it's slightly higher for those 2 weeks, would you ever, even if they're still having periods and they're in peri, would you ever put them on the lower dose every night just to see, would it suit them?
Yeah. Like, for example, if someone said, like, I'm on this cyclical and it's not really suiting me and I'm getting a lot of side effects that I'm not happy with, but my periods are very light. And depending on their age, especially in women who are kind of approaching their mid-50s, they're much more likely to avoid the spotting and breakthrough bleeding, and they're much more likely to settle on the continuous. So you might switch them over. Micronized progesterone is usually, you can take it either by mouth or you can insert it vaginally. So for some women, taking it with the vaginal approach might avoid some of the side effects as well, especially things like bloating and like part of, you know, gastrointestinal type symptoms, nausea and bloating might be avoided if they use it vaginally instead of by mouth. And like it has other, like, I'm a big fan of most of the menopause specialists are quite in favor of micronized progesterone for most women, because it has other wellness benefits outside of just protecting your womb, which isn't necessarily true of this other synthetic progestins.
And this is
seems to have some benefit. Yeah.
And this, like, it helps you sleep and stuff like that. Is that what? Yeah.
Yeah. So not sort of getting too bogged down in the science of it, but essentially if you take eutrogestin by mouth, when you break that down in your body, you throw off a thing called allopregnanolone, which is a bit of a mouthful, but it's a little kind of byproduct of breaking down your progesterone. That goes and interacts with your receptors in your brain called GABA receptors. And so when it interacts with that receptor, for the majority of women, it can make them a bit, not sedated, sounds like is overstating it, but it can improve their sleep, definitely. And it can also reduce anxiety.
Okay.
So if you think there's other medications, there's a thing called pregabalin or gabapentin, and they all have this GABA in their name because they're used for things like sometimes for anxiety and sleep. So so it's been shown to have, for most women, it should improve mood and it should improve sleep. There's maybe 15% who don't get that, and who, unfortunately, they almost go the other direction. Their anxiety might get worse, their mood gets worse, their sleep gets worse.
Oh gosh.
So they're the women that were then kind of left with trying to figure out, like, what is going to be the right option for you.
And there are other options. Okay.
Yeah. So as I say, switch from oral to vaginal, or look at some of the other synthetic progestins, some of which are almost as safe as your eutrogestin. So there are really good options out there. Or a coil is a really good, another way of getting protection for your womb without actually having to take on lots of systemic HRT or systemic progesterone into your body. So that's great for women who don't suit the eutrogestin or who don't suit progesterone. There's another medication not available in Ireland, but it's available in North America, which I'd say is going to be licensed here ultimately. I think called Duavive, which is a kind of a combination of an estrogen and something that works a bit like a progesterone. That's great for women who don't suit progesterone. And then in really certain circumstances, if we're really stuck, we'll do what's called long cycling. So women take estrogen for 10 or 12 weeks, then they take 2 weeks of progesterone, and then they take their estrogen again for 10 or 12 weeks. So they only have to take the 2 weeks of progesterone every 3 months or so.
Okay.
That is associated with a higher risk of womb cancer. And so we end up following those women with serial ultrasound. So they have to, every 6 months or so, they have to get an ultrasound just to make sure they're not developing any issues.
And would that be available for women in perimenopause or just menopause?
Not so much. Yeah, probably more. You're probably more talking about menopause for the women with the long cycling. So it's nuanced. And I suppose it's so important that you kind of figure out what's going to suit this person who's sitting in front of me. Mm. All the different progestogens, the synthetic ones, have slightly different. They're kind of good at certain things, and they'll be associated with particular side effects. So, for example, if someone has acne, some of the progestins are a bit better at dealing with that than others. So you might factor that in. Some are a bit better at dealing with bleeding. So if someone has really heavy periods, you might factor that in.
Okay.
In terms of what you pick. Yeah.
And is acne a side effect of perimenopause or a menopause?
It can be. Yes. It can be a side effect, but annoyingly, it can be a side effect both of perimenopause in general or menopause, and it can be a side effect of progesterone. So which is just like shows you the cruelness of of this thing.
I'm definitely coming back as a man.
Oh god, tell me about it. No periods, no cervical smears, no childbirth, you know. I know.
Oh,
no shaving
gosh.
Your legs. There's a lot to be said for it, really, isn't there?
But there is a kind of a because I take HRT and I'm in peri, so I'm all over the shop and I'm on a kind of a low dose of everything, but it has settled. So there is a settling in period, I suppose, like anything you start. So, you know, I think some people you started off maybe and you expect this amazing feeling, and estrogen generally is amazing. And then when you get to taking the eutrogestin, it's like crash, bang. Oh my God, right. This isn't going to be as easy as I thought it was going to be. Yeah. And for me, it's been up and down, and I could never take the pill, but I do seem to tolerate HRT much better. And maybe it is because it's through the skin or whatever. But it is, we should really be just sticking with it. Like, what kind of timeline do you give women? Because I've seen other women, I see it online, they're kind of coming off it and they can't, you know, and that just makes me feel sad, particularly if they need it.
And the temptation is to constantly tweak it. Every time you talk to someone, you're looking for perfection. Oh, we'll change this, or we'll slightly increase your dose of estrogen, or we'll do, whereas sometimes sitting back and giving people time, especially in perimenopause, because your own ovarian production of these hormones, it's doing its thing in the background, it's fluctuating, and we're kind of adding that to that a little bit. And it takes maybe 3 or 4 months to see that actually settle and respond to being on something. So you've got to give it a minimum of 3 months is what I would say.
Okay.
That said, I'd never tell someone to put up with if their symptoms or side effects are intolerable. Don't power through. Like, that's the whole point in going and seeing someone,
yeah,
is to have that support, you know. But if it's manageable, power through. Yeah, usually around month 3, month 4 is when people really do notice that things sort of stabilize and settle down.
Okay,
I would say.
But if symptoms come back, so one question I had is that, you know, they've been on it for a few months, symptoms have come back, hot flushes again, pain, achiness, all that kind of thing. That's a sign of tweaking, I'm assuming.
Yeah, again, depends on how long it's been since they, let's say you start on your HRT. So I usually tell people we would hope to see an improvement in hot flushes in particular within a couple of weeks. And that usually is how it happens, but not 100% of the time. For some people, it takes a bit longer. Mood and sleep and that kind of thing, they definitely take longer. So that's more kind of the 3 or 4 month mark, which is really frustrating and hard to have the patience for. But at least if you know that in advance, then you're kind of prepared to kind of, like, you know, you don't have false expectations. If you're still symptomatic, though, it depends what symptoms you're talking about. So in particular, a good barometer is night sweats and hot flushes if you have them or if you had them. If they come back or they're worsening or becoming more frequent, that's a real reflection that it's estrogen you're talking about and your estrogen is too low, and we step up. And it's quite common, like, this is kind of more anecdote now than based in science, but just it would be quite common that at around the 3 or 4 month mark, I would talk to someone who had started HRT 3 months ago, had been like fantastic for a few weeks, and then has noticed in the last week or two that, you know, their symptoms are creeping back in, maybe a few hot flushes, a couple night sweats here and there. That's quite common at, you know, in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably because the estrogen receptors in your body light up, like going around the house and switching on all the lights when you take your HRT initially. There's this really dramatic response to estrogen if you have dreadful hot flushes in particular. And that sort of, it sort of falls off a bit, I think, usually about kind of somewhere between the 2nd and 3rd month-ish, as if the receptors get a bit dulled to that. And so we go up on your dose and then it sort of stabilizes.
Okay. What are your thoughts on bioidentical?
So, body identical that we were talking about, that you use progestin, your body identical estrogen, they're definitely safer. That's what I always prescribe as a first line, unless there's a really specific reason that I can't, depending on the person. But my first line prescription across the board is usually body identical estrogen through your skin and use progestin, unless there's some reason that we shouldn't. What the controversy comes from is because compounded bioidentical HRT, just to really confuse you. So compounded bio-HRT is where essentially you have someone in North America being a pharmacy or whatever, but it's someone who is making up like a very individualized prescription for you. So it's not the stuff that we prescribe on prescription that is regulated, that is plant derived, but it's coming from a lab. I know what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Compounded HRT is a lot more common in North America, and that would be made up by the individual chemist.
Okay.
And there's just a question mark over how much progesterone somebody might be getting in their prescription, and therefore are they getting enough to actually protect their womb? So the British Menopause Society, the North American Menopause Society don't stand over us prescribing compounded bio-HRT.
Okay. Okay. Crikey.
So just to be a bit confusing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't come across a huge amount of that here, I have to say. Like in Ireland, it's an awful lot more regulated and standardized. So.
Okay. Testosterone. Had a couple of questions.
Testosterone.
When to add it. What to do with it. Is that the little icing on the cake?
Oh God, you're asking me all the difficult ones. So
I know, and this is only honestly, I'm looking at my list.
Controversial, but this is the stuff I'm dealing with every day. Like everybody asks about testosterone, pretty much. It's really controversial, and it's controversial because, again, totally different opinions on the two sides of the Atlantic. So it's not common in North America. It's much more common to see it prescribed in Europe, I believe. So, if you look at your ovaries, you know, they produce 3 hormones, really. They produce your estrogen that we've kind of talked about, progesterone that we talked about, and then the third hormone is testosterone. And what's interesting is when you hit menopause, we see these, you know, fluctuations in estrogen and progesterone, and then they fall off, and then you just kind of stop producing them really from your ovaries when you hit menopause. But testosterone's a little bit different because the levels sort of gradually decline through your reproductive years. So really through your 30s and 40s, you're actually dropping your testosterone levels, and then they plateau. And what's interesting is from 50 onwards, we don't see huge drops in testosterone levels. So like, they don't drop off the same way that they do with the other two. But the exception being, I suppose, surgical menopause. So women who've had their ovaries removed, if you go and check their testosterone levels 2 years later, they're 50% down. They've lost 50% of their testosterone production.
Wow.
So your ovaries continue to make testosterone after menopause. So it's a really, it's hard to explain. I don't know why some women have lower testosterone levels in menopause than others. And I don't know why some women benefit from taking testosterone versus other women. So it's complicated, you know.
Okay.
It is totally case by case. Yeah. So it's important, I guess, because you need testosterone. So you need it to make other hormones, and you need it for bone and muscles and possibly for cognition, like for concentration, and possibly for mood. You definitely need it for libido and sexual function.
Okay.
So, okay. And then just to really, like, you know, confuse everybody, if you go and measure blood testosterone levels in, you know, every woman over 50, it won't match up to what their symptoms are. So you can have someone with a totally normal testosterone level who's telling you, my libido is really low, I'm, you know, really poor sexual satisfaction scores, and vice versa. We can have women with really low testosterone who have no issues. So it shows you that it's probably, those issues are multifactorial. There's more going on than just one hormone. And so it's complicated for that reason.
Okay.
And then there's risk. So testosterone is usually prescribed as a gel. So it's usually a pea-sized amount of gel applied to your thigh once a day. And it's a really small amount because we are prescribing male testosterone. There's a thing called Androfem. There's female testosterone available, but it's hard to get. It's a bit more expensive. So we go with the male, that we don't have an awful lot of options when it comes to prescribing testosterone. So we end up prescribing this male gel. And so you use a tiny amount per day. And there's potential risks. So the risks, we think it can lower HDL, which is your good cholesterol. So we think testosterone might lower that if you're on it. It may benefit bone density, which is a good thing. There are side effects. So you can get some excess hair growth and acne, which people tend to love.
Right.
Yeah. And that can happen at any dose to anybody. It just depends on how sensitive you are to it.
Yeah.
And then the other risks would be things like a deepening of your voice and male pattern hair loss, like alopecia. Jeez. Now, okay. Yeah, I know. I'm full of good news. Yeah. However, it's important to bear in mind. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You kind of, I think women get this impression if they go on testosterone, they're going to sprout a beard and like this big deep voice. So, but in reality, we only see the alopecia, the male pattern hair loss and the deepening of the voice if you end up taking too much.
Okay.
And that's kind of really the bottom line. So it's really important to know, if you are using testosterone to improve libido and sexual function, which is the only thing it's licensed for really at the moment. You have to have blood work. So usually about 6 weeks after you start it and every 6 months after that, so that we can, you know, measure your testosterone levels, make sure you're not kind of wandering outside of where we want you to be. And then you're not at risk of developing those other issues long term. So it's really safe, but you have to be monitored. That's all.
Okay. Okay. Another question on, is menopause, can there be a hereditary link? Are you likely to go through
this? Yeah, definitely.
Okay. But is that
again multifactorial? So other things will impact on it. So if you smoke, how many pregnancies you've had, what age you are, your body mass index, how much you exercise, your diet and nutritional status, and again countless other things, like other health issues you might or might not have. But one part of that list is definitely genetic. So it's quite useful to know if someone had, you know, if they say my mom had early menopause or my mother had premature menopause, that would definitely increase your risk if those things happen.
Right.
So you don't necessarily mimic your mother, but it's a factor. Sure. Yeah.
And perhaps lifestyle as well would play a part there.
100%.
And what you're eating, drinking, exercise, all of that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I have a couple of big questions. So obviously, you know, they're probably separate podcasts, to be honest, but we'll touch on them briefly if that's okay. So I had a question about premature ovarian failure and just really struggling with sleeping, weight. You know, she's doing all the right things, working out, eating well, all of that. Is there a connection between the two? menopause and this happening and what's going on there?
Yeah, probably is the answer. Again, when you look at things like sleep and mood and that kind of thing, they're obviously, you know, they're not in isolation dependent on what your hormones are doing. So other things play a part, but, you know, having premature ovarian failure or having premature menopause. So if you have your period stop before the age of 40, there are other, like, this health impact or this health issues, I suppose, related to that happening to factor in. So it's challenging. Usually they are the people who benefit the most, I would say, from replacing estrogen and possibly testosterone. A lot of women with premature menopause or premature ovarian failure will actually really benefit from getting some testosterone. Again, case by case, and not
of course,
but just it's something to consider. But she is someone who might really benefit from HRT, but there are also other options. The benefit of HRT for someone with premature menopause or premature ovarian failure is that things like bone density and the cardiovascular risk, like we kind of, you know, mentioned earlier, they become really important. Because if you think you start losing your bone density from your 30s onwards, by the time you get to your 50s and 60s, you know, you're potentially really in trouble, depending on the person and their other risk factors. But, and it's something that we can really slow down. And the same with cardiovascular risk and heart attack risk. That's, you know, we think women really benefit if we step in with estrogen early for someone like that. But it's individual. Some people choose not to go down that route.
Of course.
Lifestyle, really important. It sounds like she's doing everything right. And there's other non-hormonal options that can be factored in. And then bone density, you know, vitamin D, really important. Dietary calcium, weight-bearing exercise. So other things you can do to certainly try and maintain your bone density, even if you're not taking estrogen.
Yeah. And I suppose, like, it is scary. And like, I from the last podcast, I had a good few women actually comments, and all really nice, but along the lines of, you know, oh, I'm not there yet. I've sailed through menopause. That was years ago. It hasn't affected me, and which is fine, great, no symptoms, absolutely. But what you're saying, the scary bit is the bones, the cardiovascular health, you know, your brain health, possibly things that could be going on behind the scenes, which kind of leads me on to the next question in a way, because so. Medically induced menopause. So for women perhaps that have had breast cancer, you know, an estrogen receptive or estrogen positive cancer, you know, what happens to women like that just, you know, can't take HRT?
There's rarely a case where it's a complete blanket can or can't.
Okay.
So really individual, but you're right. And women who have had estrogen receptor positive breast cancer, it is like it's contraindicated. And so we look at every other option first. So you start with lifestyle and talk about things that might be triggers. So it depends on what their, like, you know, constellation of symptoms might be. So if they're talking about, if it's all physical things like hot flushes and night sweats and bone, you know, joint pains, and you might treat that differently to how you treat the woman who has none of that, but a ton of vaginal dryness and painful sex, or if it's all mood issues, you might take a different route. So I suppose the first thing is to lay out, like, what are we actually trying to address here? And then separate to all of that then is long-term health factored in too. But I start with lifestyle, look at triggers. So things like alcohol and caffeine and exercise in a positive way, you know, to look at what might be having a negative or positive impact on a day-to-day basis. Cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT can be really helpful, especially if you're talking about mood symptoms or sleep. So that's something that we often discuss. And then there's medication it's non-hormonal medication. And so you can talk about using, sometimes it's antidepressants, sometimes it's other medication that had, you know, other, we'd see them used maybe for pain sometimes, but we know that they're beneficial for hot flushes. There's an old fashioned kind of blood pressure medication that seems to be good for hot flushes as well and night sweats. And there's even a bladder medication that's sometimes used to treat hot flushes and night sweats. So there are other options there.
Okay.
For the vaginal symptoms, so what are called genitourinary symptoms of menopause, like incontinence or needing to pee frequently or vaginal dryness or discomfort or painful sex, even focusing just on fixing that element of things can be really helpful for some women. And that can be safely done in women with breast cancer as well, using even low dose vaginal estrogen. So
so it's to know that there's lots of options out there.
Tons of options.
And actually, you kind of mentioned two things there that I was going to ask you. One was, so aside from medically induced menopause, had a question from a lady that she feels herself that is definitely going through perimenopause, but her doctor keeps prescribing her antidepressants. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really want to go down that route. So there's the controversy there then of, you know, does she need antidepressants? She doesn't feel depressed, but the doctor kind of keeps nudging her this way. So what do you do there? I suppose that's when you need to go and speak to a specialist, really.
And speak to her. You know, it depends on what kind of relationship she has with her GP, but I'm sure her GP would be receptive to feedback. You know, it has to be a two-way conversation. I think it's important to have the confidence and relationship with your GP that you can say, this isn't the route that I want to take, and can we explore other options? So that's where I would start.
What happens when if you're not getting that answer back, and it's a kind of a
it depends on the relationship that's there. Like, most GPs I know would be very receptive to kind of having that conversation and putting it out on the table and discussing kind of like, what is the objective here and what are we trying to treat, and what, you know, where are your priorities and how do you feel about these medications? So so communication I think is so important.
Yeah. And I think there was a kind of a blood test taken, and blood test came back with stuff, everything being in the normal range. So
God, it's the bane of my life. Yeah. So the problem with that, especially in perimenopause, is that it just gives you no information. So you can do an FSH level. So we measure a hormone that's produced by part of your brain. And we typically in menopause, we'll look to see that an FSH level will be really high in response to a really low estrogen level. So that, you know, those two things should match. But in perimenopause, because of the fluctuation of those hormones, your FSH, the thing that we measure, is all over the shop. So you can't use it to diagnose anything. There is no diagnosis of perimenopause. It's clinical. It's from talking to someone, a change in their periods, you know, appropriate age, that kind of thing. But relying on a blood test does nothing, you know.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure you, like, I'm not kind of criticizing someone for checking it. It's just, I wouldn't pin everything on a blood test. But going back to that lady, I suppose, you know, I think it's important to kind of tease out, like, in terms of mood, you know, there are, I mean, diagnosing someone with depression is really difficult. You know, it's not a case, it's not sort of an opinion based thing. Oh, I feel this person's depressed. We have actual clinical scoring like systems that we use. There's a thing called a PHQ-9 that, you know, that helps someone understand how pervasive their low mood might be, how much it's happening during the week, how much it's affecting their daily life, etc. And so it's, you know, there are ways of sort of teasing out with someone, is this hormonal or is it more likely to be clinical, like a clinical depressive episode or clinical anxiety? So we tease that out first. Antidepressants have their place in menopause. Yeah, yeah. Like, I'm not against, you know, sure. There's this opinion as well. I think people get really offended almost at the suggestion that they might need to go on an antidepressant, but in the case of the person that you're talking about, maybe she happened to mention I'm getting 27 hot flushes a day, you know, and so then the GP quite rightly thought, well, this is something that would help, because it would they have their place, but it's communication and discussion to figure out, look, is this the right route? Is it treating what we're trying to treat here or not?
Yes. Yeah.
And then weigh up, like, some women really don't want hormones.
Sure.
Or they're worried about the breast cancer risk. And obviously we discuss all of that because it's so important, but they might choose not to. And then you do explore other options, but it's all about communication. Lay it all out on the table. That's what I would say, and figure it out and speak your mind, you know?
I mean, gosh, I mean, we could be here for 4 hours. Literally, there's so many things to talk about.
Agreed.
Very briefly before I let you go, because I know you're up to your eyes. Urinary incontinence seems to be another area that is just not discussed. And I'm sure embarrassment, shame, all of those things, but there is so much that can help. Am I right?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I don't know why we don't. It's a stupid question. I do know why we don't talk about it more. No one wants to be putting their hand up and saying, you know, I'm leaking when I laugh or cough or sneeze, even though they're probably in a room where 20 other women are also leaking when they laugh or cough or sneeze. So,
and if you've had children, it's, you know, going to be probably,
especially if you've had a vaginal delivery, it can be. Yeah, although it can actually affect anybody. But you're right, like there's things that kind of make you higher risk to have that happen. But unfortunately, losing estrogen seems to have a big impact on that. So your the kind of tone of your pelvic floor muscles and the whole in, like vaginal environment is affected by losing estrogen. We lose how much collagen we have, we lose glycogen, another really important protein that kind of gives us that vaginal tone and integrity. And even changes our like vaginal pH, so you get different bacteria growing vaginally and so on, which actually increases your risk of getting urine infections, for example. But do you imagine, because where your vagina is, your bladder and ureter, the tube going from your bladder to the outside, they're all connected and on top of each other. So they all change with menopause. And so you can get, sometimes vaginal dryness can happen in isolation, but just like you pointed out, you can also get these urinary symptoms that happen alongside it. Either increased frequency, I need to pee all the time, that never happened to me before. Incontinence, either stress incontinence where you're laughing, coughing, sneezing, whatever it might be, or what's called urge incontinence, which is I feel like my bladder is full, or as soon as it's in any way full, I just can't hang on to it anymore. Latchkey intolerance or incontinence where you're at the door of your house and you're putting your key in the latch and the next thing you lose control. It's a joy. And so on. So there's all these different types. Sexual dysfunction that can come with menopause. Doesn't affect everyone, but does affect lots of women who don't want to talk about it. And libidos. I know we touched on it before, but like it's all under the one umbrella of just people are mortified and they feel they're different and they don't realize that actually I'm looking at like this symptom checker all day long. And almost every woman is taken off severe when they're talking about libido and sexual dysfunction and painful sex, you know. So it's really universal. But in terms of what you can do, there's conservative ways of managing it. So even simple things like cutting caffeine out. Caffeine's a really big bladder irritant, can really help. I won't get any new friends for suggesting that, I'm sure.
I love my coffee.
Like I won't have any incontinence, but I'll have no energy all day long. Like a briar. But anyway,
and no joy.
But even cutting back, it's not about cutting down necessarily, cutting back on it. And then sometimes looking at overactive bladder can be, you know, a huge part of this. So looking at things that can contribute to that. So, you know, like you almost have to retrain your bladder to be less bloody sensitive so that like when it's a bit more full, it's not giving you that feeling of needing to go the whole time. So, and there's different ways of doing that. Pelvic floor exercises or Kegels that I'm sure lots of people have heard of. Doing them properly can be really helpful. Vaginal estrogen, which is really low dose and really, really, really safe. So it's local estrogen, usually the tablet that you insert vaginally, and it doesn't really get into your systems. It's not really affecting the amount of estrogen going around the rest of your body. So it's really safe. Pelvic physios can be really helpful. They do great work. So there's a few that we're blessed. We've really good pelvic physios in Dublin and the rest of the country. So we're lucky in Ireland that we've got some really good options.
Yeah.
So they can be helpful. And there's a whole myriad of other options out there. But the biggest factor is women not discussing it, I think.
Yes.
And they're too scared to even bring it up with their GP or their whoever they're talking to usually.
Yeah. Wowzers. I thank you so much for your time. Caoimhe, I mean, when are you setting up? Where can people find you? Because I know that's going to be the next question I'm going to get. Where can I find her?
Yeah, well, I hope so. That would be brilliant. So I'm setting up in Dalkey. It's going to be Menopause Health is what the clinic is going to be called. And then I'm sure if they just even look up my name, so my surname is Hartley. If they go by that, they'll hopefully. You know, I would happily sit here for another hour and just.
Yeah, I mean, that was so interesting. I feel like I've just had the best science class. It's really, isn't it just incredible what goes on in the women's body?
I know. I don't know why we're not more like open. And I suppose it's just years of Catholic Ireland and probably 20 million other reasons why we don't want to talk about it.
But yeah, and we're getting there.
I think it's great.
Yeah, definitely. We're getting
and
there.
And so actually things like this, like you doing, you're like, this is brilliant doing this podcast and you're bringing it on. You
know, I've learned so much and it's so interesting and would love to have you on again at some point. It's just incredible and I wish you all the best of luck with your future endeavor. I've no doubt it's going to be fantastic. And once you're up and running, I'll get all your information. I'll have it all up on the website.
Brilliant. Thanks.
So thank you so much for taking your time because I know you're up to your eyes moving house.
I'm just here trying to avoid having to unpack boxes. So I'd happily chat for another 3 hours.
Yeah, and homeschooling and the joys of that. Crikey. Guys, if you're enjoying this podcast, maybe you could share it and subscribe to the podcast and come and check us out at thewhenpodcast.com. Thank you so much.